Thank you so much. This is really exciting. I think this has beaten the record for number of attendees in to a Learning Lab webinar. This is really exciting. What a couple sort of I wanted to put in a plug for the USA Learning Lab, which was what hosted this this webinar. You can continue the conversation through the discussion forum that I just linked to on the chat box, because I'm not sure that we're going to be able to answer every single question in the next half hour. And it's the evaluation interest group on Learning Lab is just a great resource for, you know, to continue conversations about evaluation in general and, you know, about this particular type of impact evaluation. So I'll probably mention it one more time before we close. I think what I want to do is maybe go sort of in reverse order from the presenters. So the last thing that Ariel talked about was just general, like, how do we use GIS? How do we join? How do we access aid data? And so there's some questions about GIS, the use of GIS in general, and I'm going to look at those first. So the questions are on the sort of the left-hand side of the chat box. And, you know, I think Ariel and Dan are the ones who should answer these. And then we'll go back to the specific evaluations that were discussed in these presentations. So I guess Ariel and Dan, maybe you can answer the first three questions.
Sure. So on the topic of how GIS can be used on governance projects, one example that we have of a project just launched in Colombia is a municipal governance improvement project where the government is, and with the help of several additional actors, is attempting to improve local governance. And in those cases, we can merge data that is being collected through surveys of the population in these areas and use that to link to the particular sites at which interventions are carried out. Again, the spatial aspects or the GIS aspects allow us to consider the distance from the intervention sites, as well as kind of the boundaries of the intervention sites. So it allows us to construct comparison groups in some of these cases based on the individuals that are located relatively far from where a given intervention is carried out, or individuals who are just beyond the jurisdiction of that intervention. So in the cases where an intervention involves, say, traveling to a municipal center to interact with the government. Again, a comparison group might be a set of the population that's located relatively farther away from that municipal center. Or in cases where the municipal government, again, is acting across the entire municipality, we can use spatial data on the locations of survey respondents to then construct a comparison group of individuals located just beyond the jurisdiction or in other jurisdictions not simultaneously treated. So that is one way that we can use the locational information of the GIS aspect for governance projects as well. I should mention that we are actively working now on geocoding the Afrobarometer data sets for the first six rounds, some of which had been geocoded in the past, but not to a common standard. And Aid Data itself is attempting to geocode these to a common standard together with Afrobarometer, so that we can have a standardized data set available, at least at this point, for much of Africa, covering many of these governance domain questions. Dan, I'll let you talk about the remote sensing question.
Sure. So,
Dan, if you can read the questions out loud, I think that would be helpful.
Absolutely. So one of the questions was, how can evaluators get access to some of the great remote sensing data that is being generated? This is a huge challenge. So the data sets that we were using, we're talking about daily images for 30 years. So you're up in the terabytes of data, which is really unusable for traditional audiences. One of the things that we're hard at work at here is actually generating a fairly simple to use online interface that will allow anyone to extract that data to administrative or other units of interest. So being able to upload a shapefile or select an administrative unit that you are studying and then automatically download those time series. We expect that will be rolled out in kind of early forms by the end of the summer, approaching into the early fall. And that should be the best answer to that question. Right now, unfortunately, just the scope of the data makes it very, very difficult for kind of common users to access. The other one, so I'll briefly answer number three as well. So would it be possible for the speakers to share simple, perhaps open source tools that can allow someone to do basic comparisons such as this? And that was in reference to the propensity score matching and approaches that we saw earlier. One thing that we are also actively working on, and we already have out in the wild on GitHub for those of you that do any kind of development, but will soon be on the CRAN and broader repositories, we have an R program. So R is a statistical program that allows you to do some geospatial analysis. That program is open source and allows you to do exactly these types of analysis. Now, it's not simple yet, and I won't claim it is yet. This is a relatively young methodology, and so the tools to do this are still fairly nascent. But at the same time, it allows anyone to start exploring some of these tools. I think that one thing that we would be particularly interested in is learning more about what types of tools would make your jobs easier as we begin to this methodology begins to evolve. And with that, I think I'll pass it off. It looks like number four is a question for Mark.
Okay, sorry for that. We've got my audio back on. Thank you. So the question is, what happens to the treated areas that could not be matched in the Ecuador study? And perhaps more broadly, what happens if you can't find good matches to do this type of evaluation? So there are actually lots of different approaches to matching comparison groups. So the work that Dan presented uses a model to find those comparison sites that are equally likely to be treated. That's one approach, and it requires more of a one-for-one match, which might make this problem more significant. The approach we use is actually a comparison at the level of the overall observation. So we are not matching one treatment plot to one control plot. We are looking at distribution averages across all of the variables we care about within the complete set of observations. So I suppose the short answer is there are different ways to do matching that enable this to be possible. Now, it could be the case that you just can't find good match sets. And then you have a couple of different options. One is you use further model adjustments to make sure that the control observations are similar to the treated observations. The second option is that you look entirely at those treated plots that can be matched well and that offer some basis for comparison. Both have their drawbacks. But the overall message that I want to put forward is, in doing this type of impact evaluation, and particularly matching, there are a lot of different types of techniques that need to be tailored to the application that they are applied to. And with that, I'm turning it back over to Dan, I believe.
Great. So to read the next question, a lot of the evaluation depends heavily on the measure of deforestation. What approach was taken to measure rates of deforestation? And then there were a number of very technical questions along these lines as well. So I'll try to kind of knock a lot of these out in one answer. What we ended up using was the NASA Land Long-Term Data Record, LTDR, which is a processed combination of AVHRR and MODIS data that goes back to around circa 1982. The spatial resolution of that, they standardize it to about a 0.05 decimal degree, so that's roughly 5 to 5.5 kilometers throughout the Amazon. That is NDVI, but it is heavily processed NDVI, so they account for things like cloud cover. And the other big advantage is because we have daily measurements, we're able to overcome a lot of problems that are really, really big in the Amazon. So clouds are very, very common in the Amazon, and so it's hard to see from a satellite where trees are. If you have daily pictures, however, you have a much better chance of actually capturing the variation in forest cover on the ground. We have also been testing a few other products that are helpful for measuring this. So the GIMS product we looked at, and that extends backwards in time to a similar time horizon. One big question is, why not look at Landsat, or why not go back farther? So the fundamental answer to that question is the processing costs become very, very high. So we have Landsat imagery. In theory, we could go back all the way to the 1970s, but right now the costs of doing that would be phenomenal. So even the MODIS data, which is 250-meter resolution raw, then you're talking about trillions and trillions of pixels of data. If you go to Landsat, you're talking about even more than that. So while there are a number of initiatives currently ongoing to classify the Landsat data, there's not currently a publicly available data set that has good coverage over the Amazon. The other big challenge in going back farther is that because Landsat only takes one picture every 16 days, it's frequently plagued by cloud cover issues, which MODIS, though it is at AVHR and MODIS, though they're at coarser spatial resolutions, they do have fine temporal resolutions. With that, I think I will turn it over. I believe the next one is for Mark, asking, could you explain more about fragmentation in and around treatment areas?
Yeah, and maybe I will just follow up a little bit on Dan's response to the measures of deforestation. So in our case, we use a data set put together by Hansen and colleagues that measures vegetation at 5 meters height. So there are more and more data products that make it possible to do this type of analysis around the world using common metrics. That's one thing I want to explain. The other thing is that it is now possible to validate those types of broadly available open source metrics with some of the higher resolution data that Dan measures. So in our case, we use MODIS data and a measure of enhanced vegetation index averaged over annual basis to validate some of the results that come out of the Hansen data. And we have all of that written up in very lengthy technical appendices if anyone wants to get down into the weeds. The next question was, can you explain more about fragmentation in and around the treatment area? So in our particular study, the average rate of deforestation is about 2 to 3% per year around this area. We did not look specifically at fragmentation as an outcome, but I would like to respond to one point, which is we know that there are frontier effects in these kinds of forest changes. That is, if a plot is deforested, the plots that are near to it are more likely to be deforested in the future. And so what we do as a general methodology is not only to match on all of those observable variables that I put a list up of, but also to say, around the plot, what is the level of deforestation? So let's find comparison plots that near to the plot have the same levels of deforestation. And furthermore, what is the trajectory of deforestation coming up to the treatment? So if a program goes into effect in 2002, what we do is we look back over the years before 2002, and we try to find areas that have the same trajectory of nearby fragmentation to those areas that fall under the program. So in terms of the more general application of this methodology, we think that there's a real need to think about these types of issues, particularly to make sure that you're understanding spillover effects and that you're understanding some of these other spatial dynamics that drive the results. And then maybe I'll just speak briefly to point 7 before turning it over to Ariel. So this is, now that the research team has gathered data on deforestation, could research be used to gather other types of outcomes like income or access to credit? This is absolutely the direction that our group would like to head, and we think that there are real gains to integrating this type of evaluation work into the traditional evaluation work that is already happening, oftentimes at low cost. So if there are opportunities to collaborate to build this type of data set where you're looking not only at forest cover change or other types of land use change, but also to complement that with real household level data, we think that that is potentially powerful. It just requires a commitment to work with an implementing partner that already has access to those types of data. Ariel?
Yeah, I think most of that, Mark, is exactly spot on. So I think in some cases where survey data is also available on some of these populations from alternative sources, that can be a reasonably good proxy. And in certain types of environments, again, we can use other remote sensing, remotely sensed outcome measures as well, again, lights or other measures of economic activity to merge in as well. And it partly depends on the level of, I guess, capacity and existing data in the country as well, of course. So where census data is available to a reasonably fine level, or where other national household surveys are also available to relatively fine levels, those outcomes are certainly kind of within the range of the doable. Dan, let me ask you to answer question number 8, and then we have a number of other questions that we'll try to address too in the time we have remaining.
Sure. So I will briefly engage with number 8. How do you reduce the likelihood of ecological fallacy when linking different data sets based on geography? So briefly, just to define the concerns of the ecological fallacy, this is when you have very coarse resolution data and you are going to finer resolution areas, and it's closely related to the modifiable aerial unit problem, which I heard saw a few other questions about, which is where you have units of observation that may not be measured using the same spatial units of analysis. So, for example, different administrative units or census units as contrasted to government units. In both of those cases, we treat those as sources of spatial uncertainty. So you can see actually on the slide that we're looking at right now, the first set of questions we're exploring is how precisely are locations and sites known. That applies to all of the different data sets that we are working with. And so if you have coarse resolution information, it's actually a great source of spatial uncertainty. Fortunately, there are a lot of people that have worked hard to allow us to model that type of information. This is actually closely related to another question that was submitted asking if there were any additional steps particular to spatial impact evaluations required to protect personally identifiable information. In those contexts, you can actually take that data and you can make it spatially less precise, and then you can incorporate information on the uncertainty around that data in your modeling efforts. So there's a lot of different ways to engage with this challenge, and we are actively working on solving those issues. With that, I will pass it back to Ariel on question 9.
Sure. So are any HIV/AIDS studies ongoing that are using GIS to inform those studies? I should say there are many. I do not know of any that are ongoing at the moment that are essentially attempting to use GIS as a source of quasi-experimental variation or to be able to do a causal attribution in quite the way that we're describing them. But that is certainly not because of the lack of applicability. In some sense, we are in active discussions with a number of groups who have reasonably precise information on activities carried out to combat HIV/AIDS and attempting now to merge, for example, again, the DHS data with those or other data sets such as vital statistics or national clinic or facility surveys that essentially provide some of these outcome measures, again, at pretty fine levels of precision. The spatial aspects really also let us bring in other data as well, roads information, for example, in cases where HIV/AIDS epidemics are believed to spread along transportation routes or are believed to be correlated with other baseline or background characteristics like poverty or governance. Those are instances in which we can exactly look at those cases. So there's kind of a rich set of applications in the HIV/AIDS world that we're really starting to explore. Dan mentioned briefly in response to the question about protecting personally identifiable information, and just as you would in cases where the spatial aspects are not known, one needs to essentially ensure that there is sufficient coarseness in all of the characteristics that one cannot link any particular set of responses or set of information to any one user, or sorry, any one respondent, that is essentially the application as well in the GIS world. We have to think about a richer set of variables that could be used to identify any one observation, and then assess in both the data And if it is a sample, then in the real world, what is the total population identifiable by this same data set that we have in our possession? I should say that the DHS has been releasing the georeferenced survey data for quite a while now, and they have their own standardized ways to do this. Part of it is by essentially masking the locations, introducing small degrees of error into the locations so that you cannot easily re-identify the cluster locations. So there are kind of established ways to do this, and those ways are also being constantly improved. Go ahead. Mark, I'll let you answer number 11.
Thanks, Ariel. So question 11 is it possible to crowdsource or make an intuitive interface for project recipients to self-report in order to do evaluation over longer time periods? So I think this is a really interesting suggestion in an area that's ripe for collaboration for different organizations that are doing this type of work. My sense, and I know that A-Data and our group was just at a workshop put on by USAID not too long ago where we talked about long-term evaluation, is that a lot of theories of change happen over a number of years, and that makes evaluation particularly challenging because it's just not the case that there's a continuing field presence for years and years after projects are happening. But let's say projects that are in the agricultural sector, you know, do transitions of crops brought about through extension services have lasting impacts on income? And do they spill over to other nearby farms? These are really important questions that get to the core of these programs, but are very difficult to monitor over longer periods of time. So I think that there's great opportunity to build the kinds of reporting systems that being suggested here, together with more of the macro land cover change data that one could see have the cropping system shift from single season to two crops in a season types of systems as a result of programs for, let's say, climate change adaptation. So this is an area that's ripe for collaboration, and we think a real knowledge need as well.
So I'll answer just very briefly question 12. Just a follow-up question on the NDVI. What additional aspects were taken into account to determine if the project was the main cause of the changes on the community land and not the other aspects, say climate changes? Was the climatic data and other data integrated to account for this? So absolutely. We had around 15 different covariates that we looked at. The climatic data in particular, we actually have a globally for every single month from 1900 to 2010, both temperature and precipitation measures. And we have that at a fairly fine spatial resolution, so we were able to then integrate that with our community-level data sets. With that, I will pass it off to number 13 for Ariel.
Thanks. So are the presenters familiar with any examples of layering GIS with randomized control trial impact evaluations focused on household-level labor or income outcomes? So I can talk about one example that I've been personally involved in, and that is an impact evaluation in Malawi of an agricultural extension program where the intervention was meant to have farmers adopt a more sustainable and climate resilient technology. And in that case, we were able to merge using GIS data, merge climate conditions that varied across Malawi in our intervention years. And in some of the locations, rainfall was particularly poor in our intervention years, and in some not. And we were able to use that to really test the mechanism underlying the particular intervention, again, that this technology that the farmers were adopting was really climate resilient by merging in GIS data on climate. So that is kind of one way to use that as a cross-cutting measure of, again, natural or a quasi-experimental variation, even in an RCT case where the intervention of interest is randomly varied across the population. It looks like there's quite a few other questions. We'll take just a moment to see if we can try to figure out a reasonable way to address them. For those of you who, I should apologize in advance, for those of you whose questions we did not fully address, please do email Christina, and we will do our best to address those via email as well.
And I just, again, I want to put in the plug for Learning Lab, and also ask the presenters to join Learning Lab as well, and we can continue the conversation there. There's an evaluation interest group that is, you know, that we have multiple different discussions. This would only be one of them. You know, and it's something that you know, we can share opinions, experiences, challenges, opportunities. I've also seen a great amount of exchange of emails and contact information within the chat boxes. It seems like there are many people kind of connecting with each other, and this also sets a record for the webinars. It's probably the most interactive. So this is super, super exciting.
So this is Mark Buntaine. I'll take a shot at this longer question, which is, given that two or three of the projects evaluated were related to land tenure, could we talk a little bit about the study design? So I'm just bringing up a separate slide here that I hope will talk about some of the limitations. So the first point in this question is, are there limits to the study design impact evaluation? And the honest answer is, we do the best we can, and we think we're there, but we always have to be careful to make sure that we're not overclaiming the comparison group. So here is the approach that we have taken. In the left of this slide, we talk about difference and differences. This looks at, let's say that the treated groups in a solid line have a greater increase in forest cover as compared to control groups. Well, the challenge of just a simple difference in differences approach to analysis is, maybe we've missed something else that's not the same between the treated and the control. So the assumption that we make that drives a lot of this analysis is, if we get control sites that are the same in terms of the outcome at the point of the program start, and we follow them back in time to show that they're on the same trajectory up to the program start, we're confident that those unobserved factors that we haven't accounted for, if they were truly important, they would show up in this trajectory and pretreatment outcome. So this is the assumption that we make to deal with this problem. To the second question, you know, is there a limitation to defining treatment as the presence of the program alone rather than perceptions of land tenure? We could think of this as, for those of you who are in the impact evaluation world, as an intent to treat kind of analysis, that we can't show which communities took up the intervention best, but since the goal of the implementer is simply to deploy the intervention, what we would like to do is say, given that this is how it was deployed, on average, do you have an effect? In terms of number three, do the findings lead project designers to consider the importance of incorporating new economic incentives? My answer would be, I hope so. This is often a challenge for evaluators, which is, we come up with results, and we would like those results to be used, and that's why we seek partnership with organizations like USAID to make sure that the evaluations that are happening are useful and are designed in ways that can answer ongoing questions. So thanks for the question.
Thanks for that excellent answer, Mark. We don't really have much to add from our side at this moment. I should just say one more time that if you do have additional questions, or if you want to have a conversation about the particular evaluation opportunity that you are facing or challenges that you have, we're happy to do that. And the best way to get in touch with all of us is probably through Christina Kemke and Brian Bingham, again, whose email addresses are provided. And again, encourage you to get engaged in the Learning Lab more broadly. Tanya, is there anything else that you want to add at this point? I think we've had a chance to cover most questions. If there are still major questions, please do add them to the chat box.
Yeah, I would request again that you know, join the conversation on Learning Lab. Join the evaluation interest group. There's no reason why these discussions can't have to end right now. Again, the chat has been amazing. There's been amazing participation, and I, you know, hate to cut everybody off. So again, there is now a link being put on the chat box for continuing your discussion. So please go ahead and continue if you can. We're going to move over to some poll questions in a moment. So please take the time to answer the poll questions, those of you who are left. And again, I would like to thank everyone who joined. I'd like to thank the presenters for their long involvement, for sitting and answering all the questions patiently. And I want to thank the 260-odd people who joined, some of you in very unforgiving time zones. So I'm really gratified that you know, our level of interest was incredible, and I'm really happy about that. So again, I just want to thank everyone who joined in, who asked questions, who answered questions. This has been great. So please check the polls. Please go ahead and answer them really quickly. I'm gonna answer them myself as well. And then after that, I will, you know, look forward to continuing the conversation.